Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
Doing fine. Just kind of dealing with the roller coaster weather.
Roller coaster weather, yeah. 60, 30, 60, 30, 40, yeah. 15. Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
I was in shorts and long sleeves earlier this week, and now you might need tights and boots.
And lobster gloves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Close to it.
Yeah, it's the fingers and toes and ears that always get it for me.
We're still not having a December.
We're not. And we're not getting any snow to speak of either.
No.
Oh, that's that S word. That four-letter S word. So, lots of doings with the UCI still, and that new group, Change Cycling Now. Change Cycling Now held a press conference last Monday, but there hasn't been a lot released except that Greg LeMond offered to take on the role of interim president of the UCI while they sort of hash things out, but I don't know where that's going. It turns out, I found this out from our friend Leslie Cohn at Cyclismes in New York, that there is a code of ethics that was put in place at the UCI in 2011. And it pointedly details what members of the UCI may and may not do, including taking gifts, applying pressure or harassing anyone, and especially being politically neutral. They have to be politically neutral. So it seems that Mr. McQuaid is in violation of several of the articles included in the code, and to date, no one has filed a request for inquiry, which would be necessary to build a case for having members of the management committee removed for violations. So as we say in the media, stay tuned. There appears to be a lot more coming. There are supposed to be some stories breaking this coming week.
The one thing I read coming out of Change Cycling Now is that they are advocating against the zero tolerance policy that teams like Sky have put into effect. So they're looking for more of a truth and reconciliation approach.
With some amnesty for certain riders? Okay.
Yeah. They don't think that zero tolerance and, you know, throw anyone out who's ever been implicated or admits. I don't think that's the way to clean it up. So we'll see.
Well, I think you said originally that that was probably a good idea. I mean, who'd be left? There is that part of it.
Could be a thin field.
Could be a thin field.
I also wonder about these alleged violations by the UCI. Are they prior to 2011 or since 2011?
I think some are prior and some are ongoing.
Yeah.
You know, harassment has been ongoing.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah.
You know, that hasn't changed. It seems like it's still there.
Yeah.
You know.
We will see.
We will see. We are coming into the holiday season, and I'd like to wish everybody, including me, a happy Hanukkah. Tonight's the first candle, and we will add some unusual gift ideas to our news coverage tonight. I've got two cute little ideas that I found. And do you have a cycling gift on your list, Greg? Have you been naughty? Have you been nice? Have you been...
I would rather not say about my behavior.
Okay.
On my wish list are things you can't buy in any bicycle shop.
Can you buy them in any store?
No.
I didn't think so.
But I'll...
You mean like ending world hunger and peace?
Stay tuned then in the next few weeks. By the end of the year, I'll have an update for you on whether I got my gift or not. How
okay.
about that? We'll just leave it there.
Okay. Okay. Oh, boy. Suspense.
A little suspense.
It. So we have one last item before we move on to this week's show. Cleveland has been much maligned over the years, as we know, for a variety of reasons, including having our river and even one of our mayor's hair catch on fire. The truth is, Cleveland is a gem in many ways. And in a very short period of time, Bike Cleveland, along with many of the bicycle advocates working for other programs in the area, have accomplished a lot. And next Monday, there is a little party on the bridge. As the Hope Memorial Bridge, which, by the way, was named after Bob Hope, who is from Cleveland, opens its bike lanes crossing the aforementioned Burning River, the Cuyahoga. So big shout out to everybody at Bike Cleveland and Joe Simperman, Councilman Simperman, who is supplying the coffee, and Bon Bon Bakery, who is supplying pastries. So if you're in Cleveland, go ride your bike across the Hope Memorial Bridge Monday morning, and they're going to give you coffee and pastries and it's our own dedicated lanes. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is what we got in exchange for not having bike lanes on the new Innerbelt span, I remember correctly.
It is, and I'm not so sure it's a bad exchange because the Innerbelt is, what, 6 lanes of 50 miles an hour?
Well, if they were designed right with, you know, barriers and that, I mean, they bike across the Brooklyn Bridge in New York for crying out loud.
True.
So I think it could be made safe. But I do agree with you that this was a pretty good trade.
I think it's pretty good.
It's something that falls into the bird in the hand category.
Yes, it does, indeed.
Because we actually have this on the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge now, as opposed to waiting to try to get it on the Innerbelt.
On the Innerbelt. Yeah. Well, the money was there. Use it while we have it, because I think the money would have gone away.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So should we move on?
Let's do that.
We have two really good guests this evening. Our first is Ira David Levy. He's the producer and host of Pedal America, which is a PBS one-half-hour show. It's about to enter its second season on the air. Ira David focuses on cycling from the non-competitive perspective and has filmed all over the U.S. It incorporates a bit of history, a bit of humor, a lot of unique and interesting riding. Ira David is an avid cyclist as well as a journalist, and I think our conversation is going to be fun and lively. I did have the opportunity to watch 4 episodes, and it's really a well-produced show. I'm very excited about talking with him. We'll also welcome back to the show Joe Friel, Mr. Father of Triathlon Training. Even though Joe is arguably one of the most famous triathlon coaches in the U.S., his new book, The Power Meter Handbook, might appeal to anyone who has thought about adding some sort of power reporting to his or her training regimen. Joe will join us, as I said, in the second half of the show and help sort out the mystery of how, why, and when to use power meters for training and racing. And we've got some interesting news to report. So let's get to it and welcome Ira David Levy to The Outspoken Cyclist. Ira David, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Diane. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the idea of a television series about cycling has been bandied about for a lot of years. You're the one, though, who actually made it happen. So would you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk about your show?
Sure. I started out in professional media in upstate New York, in radio and television. Worked for CNN in Atlanta for a little while, and pretty much branched out on my own to pursue a freelance print career. But for the past 16 years, I had been actually teaching college media studies and journalism here in Chicago. And that's been quite rewarding. But I got to a point in my life where I felt things were compartmentalized. I had my teaching in one corner of my life, I had my cycling passions in another, my freelance print career someplace else, and, you know, like we all live our lives like this. We move in and out of different parts throughout our week and our month and our year, and that's all fine, but I got to a point where I desired a new professional challenge, and so I took some time. I tapped into myself. I asked how I can harmonize all of my passions into a single idea. So one day while I was driving to the college, it came to me like a light bulb just kind of shot through me, and I knew that I had found it. And that idea was I was going to produce a national TV series that would inspire others to ride and enjoy their bikes.
And you were driving your car at the time.
I was driving my car at the time.
By the way, that doesn't surprise me. It's like some people get their ideas in the shower. Some people get their ideas in their car.
Wherever it comes from.
Exactly. You have a lot of history with bicycling to begin with. And that was all before you actually came up with your show idea.
That's right.
So could you fill us in a little bit on what kind of riding you were doing? And I'm especially interested in the education program that you put together for surviving children of the 9/11 disaster.
Right. Well, a lot of the riding that I've done in my my adult life really has been long distance riding, where I'm going out for a week long trip, someplace with some friends. I've also done a lot of nonprofit charitable, week long events to raise money for good causes. And there was one particular summer of 2002, well, a year before, prior, I was planning to ride in parts of Europe, but then 9/11 took place, And I really wanted to go back to New York. I'm born and raised in New York City. I wanted to go back there and volunteer, help out, do what I can. My family lives very close to where the World Trade Center stood, New World Trade Center now is standing. But I couldn't because I had my own teaching career going on. So I just kind of, something, again, at that time, also another light bulb idea. I was going to cancel my biking trip in Europe and instead ride across the United States and raise college funds for children who lost parents in 9/11.
What a great idea. I don't think anybody has ever mentioned anything like that. And obviously, many of these children would have lost the opportunity for education if their parents are gone. So is that program still in place?
Not really. It was a long time ago.
Okay.
We donated every single penny that we raised, and we went to the Twin Towers Orphan Fund. Now, I think that fund does still exist, but the 9/11 New York Education Ride, which is what I called my ride, my event, it doesn't really exist anymore. Our website is still up. People can go and enjoy it and look at our daily ride and blogs and experiences, but and if they want, they can donate something to the Twin Towers Orphan Fund, but I'm not really part of that right now.
Got it. So let's talk about Pedal America, because I think that many of us who are cyclists and who have been in the cycling world have always said, how come there's not a show about bicycling on television? And now there is. So tell us the basic premise of the show, and then we'll get into sort of the nuts and bolts of how it got put together.
Sure. Well, the basic premise is very simple, which I kind of alluded to already, and that is we want people to get on their bikes and enjoy riding, just like they did when they were kids. The series does not focus on the images that most people see in the media and in magazines, the Lance Armstrongs and, you know, wearing spandex. And, you know, usually when people think of bicycling, they often think of, if it's mountain biking, they think of, you know, having to careen over mountaintops, you know, and jump off of cliffs and, you know, be 10 feet in the air and look all sporty and soupy. And with road bikes, is people, you know, riders zooming past with their spandex and, you know, 25 miles an hour. And our show is nothing about that at all. It is all about recreational cycling, travel by bicycle for the everyday person. And we also try to address a lot of the perceived barriers that people do have about cycling, that it's not safe, that, you know, I don't look good in spandex, I don't like helmet hair, you know, those kinds of things, because it is safe. We just need to, people just need to be educated, like in everything else.
So you choose a venue, and then you sort of build a topic around that venue, and you seem to find local people to get involved with you for each show.
That's
how
right.
Do you choose your topics and your venues?
That's a great question. I usually start with the League of American Bicyclists in Washington, D.C., or the International Mountain Bicycling Association, which is based in Boulder. The League of American Bicyclists has a rating system for cities and townships and even businesses that are bicycle-friendly. I think that's a really great place to start, because one of the criteria I have for places where we go to, a location needs to be bicycle-friendly or working toward becoming more bicycle-friendly, or at least that they have the desire to and that they're trying to figure it out. Because I kind of feel that if I'm going to encourage people to explore a place by bicycle, that they should have the infrastructure that's going to help them feel comfortable and to be safe.
So I watched several of the episodes. For example, I think in several of them, you were actually riding an upright bike, flat bar bike.
That's
and,
right.
You know, you're wearing kind of the looser clothes. You were wearing a jersey and you were, you know, sort of just riding along and talking with people. It seems like it's casual and informative. And I was learning stuff about the areas where you were cycling.
Well, that's what we want to do. And that, really, that is the bottom line, again, to show people that you don't need to wear spandex. You can wear your T-shirt and shorts or whatever it is that makes you comfortable, and go out and just have a good time and talk, just as you might be out with your friend or family member on a trail someplace and just going at a leisurely pace and having a good old time. That's what it's really all about. And so that's what we show on the series. But we want it to be educational as well. You know, I feel like the travel aspect offers the broad appeal. But we also want people to know that there are certain things that you do need to pay attention to keep yourselves and other people around you safe. So, and also we want people to feel connected to their bikes.
I'd like to take one moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Ira David Levy. He is the producer and host of Pedal America, a PBS television series. And we're going to talk a little more about the nuts and bolts of the series. So the first season is, as they say, in the can. That was 2012. How many episodes were there?
We did 7.
Nice.
We produced 7 episodes for season number 1, and we are planning to produce 10 for season 2.
Because PBS has a tendency to rerun things, is it still running?
Yes.
In certain, okay.
Yes, many of the PBS stations around the country are continuing to rebroadcast season 1. In fact, the series also airs on PBS's Create TV network, and we are continually running on that 3 times a week.
Nice.
Yes, and our promos start soon too.
For the for season 2?
I think they're just general promos about the series.
Got it. So do you have a staff who help to research and do your writing, or are you, you know, like a one-man band?
No, I'm not a one-man person, but I do have, I do most of the preliminary research and writing of the scripts, and then I will sit down with my production manager, Stephanie Rabiola, and we will hash things out, and she will often take the lead from there in coordinating a lot of the logistics for the episodes. But I do have a wonderful crew around me. I have a couple of other, you know, producers who help me with, you know, the business end and social media and sponsorship. And, of course, I have a great field crew, videographers and sound mixers, and we have terrific editors. So I do have a lot of people around me.
How long does it take to actually produce an episode? What kind of time frame is it?
Well, when we're out in the field, we usually give ourselves about 4 to 5 days to shoot an entire 30-minute episode. It takes time. We have to, we're traveling, we're moving equipment around the country. We have to be prepared for the unexpected, so it's important to have those 4 or 5 days, although sometimes we get it done in 3.5 to 4 days. And then use the other time wisely. But then there's a lead time once we get back to Chicago and we sit down and go into the editing room and get the episodes mastered. It's about that process is a little longer. That takes about 3 months.
How are you funding the show? I know it can't be inexpensive to produce a television series.
It's not inexpensive. you're correct. Sponsorship, basically, that is it, sponsorship. We try to, it's kind of a funny thing for me. It's very important for me to align myself with partners that share similar messaging and like-minded brandedness and worldviews. It's not easy at all to go after any sponsor. But it's important to me to find sponsors that really share our direction and our philosophy, because I think that makes it a win-win situation for everybody. And I want my sponsors to succeed along with us. And we are succeeding. We're building our brand to take some time, but we are succeeding, and I want our sponsors to succeed as well. But it's a long and daunting process.
I noticed that your sponsors are people like a car company and a, I think it's Healthy Oats.
Better Oats.
Yeah, Better Oats.
We're thrilled to have Subaru of America as our anchor sponsor, and Better Oats Oatmeal as one of our sponsors. Subaru has a very, they're very environmentally conscious brand. And, of course, Better Oats is a very health-oriented brand.
Right.
So we're very happy to, we think it's a nice combination. We're happy to have them.
So can you give us a little preview of season two? Do you know where you're going, or have you already done some of the preliminary work? Obviously, you must have.
Well, yes. pretty much all of our locations are set, except for, I think, one. But pretty much we know where we're going to be. I can give you a few places. I don't really...
You don't want to tip your hand.
We will be in the nation's capital. We plan to be in parts of Washington State, Tennessee, North Carolina, and... Where else? Boy, so we're actually, Vermont, and we're actually going to be in Canada.
Nice. Well, you know, the invitation, I made this invitation before, is that you can always come to Northeast Ohio. We'll show you a good time here.
We would love to at some point. In fact, you know, we actually have a nice following in different cities in Ohio.
Well, and we have a really nice national park here that I don't know how much it gets talked about nationally, but the Cuyahoga Valley National Recreation Area is really very beautiful and is more bicycle friendly than it's been in a long time. So how does a station choose to carry Pedal America, and do you have a part in that?
Right. Great question. The presenting station for Pedal America here in Chicago is WTTW National Productions. They're the station that we're working with. And what they do, once our episodes are mastered and complete, they are distributed through American Public Television, WTTW. They will do outreach to the other stations. There's also American Public Television also has a marketplace that takes place on a quarterly basis that all PBS stations, public television stations, are part of, where shows are presented to them and they get to pick and choose which shows they'd like to pick up. And those that don't maybe pick up our series or someone else's series right away, the presenting station will usually do outreach. But right now, we're in more than 87% of public television's household reach, so we're doing quite well,
I guess,
for our first season.
Well, I am just thrilled that there is a television series about bicycling that allows everyday people to see how they can get on a bike and go and ride. I just think it's awesome.
Well, thank you, Dan. You know, I feel like the time is right for a show like Pedal America. We have some real challenges in this country right now. We have obesity, climate change, financial hardships, and I feel bicycling addresses all of these issues. First of all, it's exercise. You get a chance to go out there, even if it's just 1 mile or 2 miles a day in your own neighborhood. You're out there. You're doing something for your for the benefit of your body. It reduces carbon emissions. It's less expensive than gas. It's, you know, it's practically free to get on your bike. And again, we're not anti-car, but it is. And you know, there are a lot of articles out there right now in newspapers like USA Today and the Wall Street Journal that are publishing articles on the growing trend. Bicycling is a growing trend. Infrastructure is being installed across the country to make cycling safer and more comfortable for people who do want to get on their bikes. Companies are offering incentives and facilities to encourage their employees to bike to work. And if you go online to a lot of these travel websites like the Pricelines and the Expedias and those kinds of those services, hotels are listing local bike shops and rental opportunities, and a lot of hotel chains are also starting to offer bicycles complimentary with rooms. So we feel the timing is right.
I think you're right. I couldn't agree with you more. Well, Ira David, I so appreciate you taking the time to tell us about Pedal America, and I look forward to season two. When will the first episode air in 2013?
Well, we're working on that right now.
Okay.
A lot of that is contingent upon when we can secure all of the funding, because as being a financially responsible producer, I don't start production until I know I have every penny secured to deliver everything I need for our sponsors and for them to succeed. So as soon as we do that, we'll be able to start production and then finalize those dates. But if I have just a minute, we are trying something new. It's just an idea that we're trying. We did launch a Kickstarter campaign.
Did you? Good for you.
We did, just to produce one episode. We wanted to produce a winter episode, and but we wanted to try something new and try and do it without corporate sponsorship, so that we can get on the air just a little bit earlier. So we're trying that, and we'll see what happens.
Has it already launched?
The Kickstarter campaign has launched. I think we have like 10 days left.
Very cool. So if somebody's interested in finding out about the Kickstarter, they would go to what, Pedal America on Kickstarter?
Actually, they can get the link on our Facebook page, but they can also go to Kickstarter. I think if they Kickstarter.com, and I think that they click on the film and video section and someplace we're in there.
Very cool. Well, again, I wish you a lot of luck. I look forward to seeing Pedal America on our local public television station, and I hope you have a great holiday season.
Thank you, Diane, and I really appreciate the time and being here with you and your listeners. We do have, as I said, a nice following in Ohio, so I appreciate it, being able to reach out to them.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Stay well. Happy holidays.
You too. Bye-bye.
Ira David, who is the producer and host of Pedal America on PBS, joined us from Chicago, Illinois.
Isn't it cool that there's a TV series about cycling?
I've got to go watch some of these because I've seen a few attempts, shall we say, in the past.
He does a nice job. Yeah, he does a nice job.
I've never seen anything that really really struck me. So I'm curious as to I want to see this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just let you come to your own conclusions. But I learned some cool things about each of the places he went. There's some history, which I like. You know, it's like living vicariously through Ira David's bicycle trips.
I like the approach of taking a non-enthusiast's point of view with it and just trying to make it about, people who happen to ride bikes as opposed to cyclists.
Right.
I think that's a good take.
I think so, too.
Well, it's a good time for us to take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we're going to have some news.
We are.
And then talk to Joe Friel about power meters.
Yes, we will.
Stay tuned for that right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
I'm in the car next to you on the highway. I sit in front of you on the bus. I'm one out of every six Americans, and I'm struggling with hunger. This isn't an uncontrollable epidemic. There's enough food in this country to feed every hungry person. Please, visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank. Every dollar you donate helps provide 7 meals for those around you, quietly struggling with hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. What's in the news, Diane?
So if I say to you, what me worry, you would say?
Alfred E. Newman,
Mad
Magazine.
There you go. Yeah. Well, I didn't even know that Mad Magazine was still being published.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. In fact, Mad issue number 519, which is this month's issue, has the Mad 20 Dumbest Things of 2012 cover. And guess who leads the dumbest things of 2012? That would be Lance Armstrong.
How did I know?
Yeah, it's hilarious. You know, I have not read or seen one of these magazines, and I had to do a double take to see what was going on. So there's a picture of Lance in a yellow jersey on a bike, hands up as if he's coming across the line with hypodermic needles sticking out of him in his arms and his legs and his helmet. It is really weird. I'm telling you, I didn't even know they were still publishing the magazine.
You can see it at madmagazine.com. I'm looking at it right now.
Isn't it hilarious?
Yes.
ESPN actually is the one who debuted the cover for Mad. So we're moving on. Sometimes the gene pool has a way of thinning itself out, you know? Unfortunately, this happened in Northeast Ohio in Painesville Township. A Lake County man is recovering after being hit by a train. This was last Monday. Deputies with the Lake County Sheriff's Office said Niles Seeley, 18, of Painesville, may have been trying to beat an oncoming westbound train when he was struck around 9:30 a.m. December 3rd. According to witness accounts, deputies said Seeley had been racing alongside the westbound train on his bike and was struck when the train entered the intersection along U.S. 20 Mentor Road. Evidence suggests Seeley may have tried to cross the intersection ahead of the train, but was instead clipped by the engine. The impact of the crash caused Seeley to be thrown from his bicycle and roll several feet off the north side of the road. Paramedics rushed Seeley to TriPoint Hospital with serious injuries before transporting him to MetroHealth Medical Center in Cleveland via life flight. Deputies do not believe alcohol or drugs played a role in the crash. The accident remains under investigation with the Lake County Sheriff's Office.
No alcohol or drugs, but plenty of stupidity.
That's what I said. We're thin in the gene pool with this one. I mean, how bizarre is that? All right. This is kind of a cool story. It's written by Tracy Lowe and Alita S. Perez for USA Today. It was published on December 2nd. Bicycle-shaped signals, which are common overseas, are now used in at least 16 U.S. cities. Drivers in bike-friendly cities may be doing double takes as bicycle-specific traffic signals pop up alongside the traditional round red, yellow, and green signals controlling intersections. At least 16 cities, including Austin, Denver, Minneapolis, San Francisco, Seattle, and Washington, D.C., have installed the lights, which feature a bicycle-shaped signal, according to an October study commissioned by the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Federal Highway Administration. The signals are common in Germany, Sweden, and Australia, according to the study. The reason for the new signals? Bicyclists can be at risk when entering an intersection on a yellow light that allows enough time for cars to clear the intersection, but not for bikes. Even traditional green lights may not allow enough time for a bicyclist starting from a stop position to make it across. So bicycle signals can also help prevent collisions when a motorist is turning right and a cyclist is going straight by allowing the cyclist a few seconds head start. Some bicycle signals stand alone, while others are incorporated into regular traffic signals. Some are timed, while others are activated when a bicyclist approaches the intersection, the study found. And it goes on to explain more about it, but it sounds like a really good idea. What they're trying to do is figure out whether they're going to get in these signals in Salem, Oregon. That's who was doing the study. What do you think?
You know, it's like at the drag strip. You know, the slower car gets a few milliseconds head start on the tree. To make it
I was just going to say the tree, you know, so red, yellow, green, bicycle.
Yeah.
That's cool. I said we were going to talk a little bit about gifts. I'm going to talk about two. These two items were brought to my attention by Ted Johnson at Commute by Bike. So thanks, Ted. The first item piqued my interest because it's for women who wear skirts when they ride. It's handmade by a little company called Bird Industries. The skirt garter clip is, quote, for those of you who believe you don't have to give up style when you ride your bike. Keep the earth happy. Earn your hipster street cred doing track stands and fixie skids and do it all looking good in a skirt. A skirt garter is an elastic band that fits around your leg and clips to your skirt to keep it from flying up. The band has a silicone backing to keep it in place. The clip is metal with plastic teeth to protect any delicate fabric of your skirt or dress. No longer will you live in fear of a strong gust of wind, have to wear bulky shorts under your skirt, or tote around a change of clothes. All you need is one little garter, or two if you're extra modest. They are all hand-dyed, so the color may vary. And the girl who makes them says she'll dye garters to your color of choice. So you can find it on Etsy. Her name is Amanda Stolle, and it is, again, Bird Industries. It's cute, and it's very inexpensive. It's just this little band with a little clip. It's a, you know, it's one of those, I needed something, therefore I made one. The second item is another why didn't I think of that item. So have you ever had to carry your bike up steps?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is an easily attached bicycle carrying handle. It originally began as a Kickstarter project. The original frame handle is designed for commuters. It's a minimalist handle It makes carrying your bike actually feel easier and lighter by lowering the center of gravity and using your normal muscle groups for lifting and holding the bike, same as lifting a grocery bag or carrying a briefcase. The frame handle, aka the Little Lifter, is a comfortable, stylish, sturdy, and easy-to-use leather handle for carrying your bicycle, whether it's up the stairs, across the tracks, or onto the metro. The frame handle has two adjustable buckles, one that wraps around the down tube, one around the seat tube. It could be mounted above the front derailleur and below most water bottle cages. The regular size frame will fit most bikes. Large belts are available upon request for larger bike tube diameters. Available in honey, dark brown, or black, which, by the way, are the same as the three leather colors from Brooks on their tape. Well, originally. Now they have a gazillion colors. It is another Etsy, and all items are made to order, by the way, so it takes a couple of weeks to get them. I have trouble lifting a bike up the steps, especially if it doesn't have a top tube. You know, if it's a mixty style or a long sloping tube, you don't have a top tube to pick it up and hoist it on your shoulder.
I thought all bikes came with built-in handles, to be honest with you, but, you know.
You mean like your
whatever.
Hands?
No, the tubes, the seat, all those great places you can grab onto. It's like
carrying it up the steps, though. I'm telling you, for somebody like me who's short and who, you know, I mean, I don't have a 14-pound bike.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. I thought it was a good idea, and evidently it did okay in Kickstarter. It got funded.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you like statistics?
Sometimes.
Yeah, I know. I know you can skew them any way you want. But a whole bunch of cool information came in via Adventure Cyclists this week, and I thought several of them were interesting. European bike tourism generates 44 billion euros annually. I thought that was a big number. In September, researchers in the UK and the Netherlands found that bicycle tourism, including day trips and overnight trips, generate about 44 billion euros, or $57 billion. The comprehensive study indicates that the bike tourism sector generates 2.3 billion cycle trips in Europe every year and also takes visitors and their money to rural areas that are not often visited by other tourists. That's a big number. There's been a greater global interest in bike tour business. Big surprise, given that number. This year at the Adventure Travel World Summit in Lucerne, Switzerland, there were more bike tour operators than ever. There were also many tour operators which have focused traditionally on walking and trekking tours that are now edging into bike travel as an alternative and growing revenue stream. Companies also noted stronger demand for their bike tour offerings. KE Adventure Travel, based in England, has seen classic bike journeys such as the Bhutan's Thunder Dragon Ride and Nepal's Pokhara to Kathmandu attract double the numbers they did in 2011. So double the numbers in 1 year. That's pretty good. And the last item, leave it to Red Bull to come up with a crazy cycling event. This time it's the second annual Red Bull Fox Hunt.
Okay.
All right. This was reported by Bike Radar. Red Bull Fox Hunt took place for the second year in a row at Cave Hill Country Club in Belfast as Guy Atherton yet again chased down the pack to try and take first place. So it's the concept, which is a traditional fox hunt sort of turned on its head, with the fox, or Guy, chasing down the pack of riders who are given a head start with the aim of passing as many riders as possible. As Guy himself says, it's going to have to be attack the whole way down. Watch the ticker as Guy Atherton passes rider after rider on his way to the front while some competitors just bite the dust as he roars past. However, the winner this time was Dublin rider Greg Callaghan, who managed to just hold off the world champion. This time, Guy bettered last year's sixth place with a respectable second, but has declared he will be back next year to take first. It's a 2.5-minute video. It's available on chopmtb.com as one of this week's three favorites.
Okay, then. Let's close the door on this week's news.
Okay.
And move along to our final guest for the hour.
Yes, we will. We are going to talk once again with Joe Friel, who is arguably one of the most popular and most listened to triathlon coaches in the country. His new book, The Power Meter Handbook, A User's Guide for Cyclists and Triathletes, has been now published by Velo Press. And since power seems to be the word of the day, we're going to find out all about how to use a power meter, and why. Joe, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Diane. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, our topic this evening is a hot topic. It's about power meters. And I hear so much about power and the need for power. I'd like to begin by asking about something you mentioned in the beginning of your book, The Power Meter Handbook. You actually offer several warnings, including one that power meters are not perfect and that perhaps we are losing the ability to feel what is right. You state that you're afraid that the athletes may be losing their sense for the art of racing. Tell me what that means.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, if an athlete's batteries should die on every device he's got on his bike or her bike, they still should be able to keep on racing and perform just as well. And that's probably not always the case, that once you become so focused on numbers after a while that people begin to discredit or not even pay attention to their own feelings. When I started doing this back in the 70s, late 60s and 70s, that's all we had. Basically, a stopwatch and how you felt was it. And stopwatch didn't tell you very much at all, really. It was mostly how you felt. So that's still important. We still need to be able to participate based on the art of racing rather than just the science and technology of racing. So I like to encourage people to do that occasionally. I'll have clients take their head unit off the bike, for example, stick it in the back pocket and see how they do on a workout without any numbers in front of them, just in case that should happen in a race.
So you think that people have become too dependent upon data instead of upon knowing how they feel and what's going on? I mean, it used to be you would take your pulse rate in the morning and you might take it again in the afternoon and, you know, remember what you ate and how much you slept. And those were interesting ideas that would tell you how you felt. But today it's so different with all the software and hardware and computers.
Yeah, it's a tricky issue. I've got absolutely nothing against using data appropriately. But athletes sometimes become so focused on the data that they forget everything else that's going on around them, including how they feel. This has really stood out for me with heart rate monitors. We haven't got to this point quite with power meters yet, but heart rate monitors, we got there a long, long time ago. I probably get one email a week from an athlete, unsolicited, somebody I don't even know, asking me or telling me that they just did a workout and their heart rate was extremely high for part of the workout. Should they see their cardiologist? That's a good example, I think, of not really having any idea of what's going on with the body just because they see a number on their handlebar, which more than likely occurred because they got some bad data, some intercept, something interfered with their transmission. Or I've got a jersey I wear when I ride. If I go downhill wearing this jersey, my heart rate goes to 230, 280 per minute. I know it's just that jersey flapping. In fact, today I was wearing that jersey and I put my hand over my chest as I was going downhill to keep the shirt from flapping. And sure enough, my heart rate dropped back down to something like 90 instead of being 280. So we get, you know, sometimes they take the numbers so seriously that it's almost scary, I think. And heart rate is a fine example of that. We're not quite to that point yet with power, but with heart rate, we most certainly are.
So why is power an important gauge of how you're doing? So how is power used?
Power on a bicycle is used to measure performance. We don't have a way to measure performance otherwise. Obviously, if you're in a race, the first person to the finish line is the winner, and that's a measure of performance. But in training, we don't really have that to go by. We don't have races every time we get on our bicycle. So somehow we've got to be able to measure progress or see how we're doing. And if you don't have power, you really don't have anything at all that tells you output. And that's because of the wind. If you're riding into a headwind, you could be going 16 miles per hour and working really, really hard. Or you could be riding with a tailwind, riding 16 miles per hour and riding really, really easy. So it speed doesn't really tell us anything that's going on at all with riding a bicycle. Heart rate is questionable at times. It doesn't really tell you anything about performance. It tells you about how you feel, about input, about effort. It doesn't tell you how you're doing as far as output. You can have a very high heart rate and finish last. So performance is a real nice measure of performance, and it's the only one we have on a bicycle, really.
So Let's talk about the actual power meter itself for a moment. Would you explain what a strain gauge is for those who don't know?
Yeah, sure. A power meter typically has like 8 strain gauges built into it. You might think, if you want to visualize something, visualize a little piece of tinfoil, maybe the size of a postage stamp or smaller, and on that little piece of tinfoil is a little curving electrical element built into it that passes electricity or electrons through it. And as you press on the pedal, you deform that little piece of material. And as it deforms, either stretches or compresses, when that happens, it changes the resistance or the impedance on the little piece of the device. And that changes the way the electrical current flows through it and is reflected in your handlebars as torque, which is one component of power. The other component is cadence, or how fast you're turning the pedals. So the little strain gauge is telling the device how much force you're applying to the pedal, how hard you're pushing down the pedal is what tells the device.
So there are now quite a few companies offering power output devices, and I know that sometimes it was in the hub, sometimes it's in the crank. You have a chapter in the book called Kilojoules, Average Power, and Normalized Power. And I really like the way you explain the human body's efficiency in that chapter. Can you explain that and how the rider can maximize his or her efficiency?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good one. I spend a lot of time talking to athletes about how to become more efficient. And basically, when you ride a bike, we're roughly a bit between 20 and 25% efficient. Actually, it's pretty close to 23% for most athletes, give or take a tiny amount, quite honestly, no matter if we're talking about a pro or a novice. Most of the energy we expend in pedaling a bicycle is lost as heat. So we're always giving off this heat. It's radiating from our bodies. And a small piece, the 23%, is what didn't get lost as heat. It winds up actually transferring to the pedal and eventually to the tire, where it comes in contact with the pavement, and so you go forward. So we're not very efficient, but that's just the way it is. It's just the way it is for humans pedaling a bicycle. So how can we improve that? Well, it can't be improved gigantically, but there are some things we can do. We can improve our pedaling skills, for one thing. For example, how long the force is applied to the pedal is important. So somebody who is a masher, you've probably heard this term before, I'm sure the readers or listeners have, somebody who's a masher tends to push the pedal down at about 3 o'clock position really hard and lets up just before it hits the bottom. So we've got a very short range of force application to the pedal, that torque I was talking about earlier. But somebody who's a spinner tends to apply the force much earlier in the pedal stroke, say around 1 o'clock instead of 3 o'clock, and then continue through a longer range down to perhaps 5 o'clock before it begins to wane. And so consequently, that person is more efficient. They're getting, with no more effort being applied, they can apply, get a higher power output, simply because they drive the pedal for a longer period of time on the downstroke as opposed to a very short period of time. So efficiency can be changed, but not a lot. It's still going to be roughly between 20 and 25%. You can just make small changes in it.
I see. So you also say that the data is produced when using a power meter is important to see if you're achieving the markers of race readiness you've set for yourself. So is it all part of analyzing the progress in terms of fitness and readiness?
Yeah, you bet. If an athlete is turning for some event, no matter what it is, I don't care what event we pick, if there's performance the athlete is concerned about, we can measure that performance in training and gauge our progress toward that performance, that event-oriented performance. So, for example, let's say that I'm going to do a road race, and I know in my road race, there's going to be a climb, which is going to take 5 minutes, and I know I need to be able to climb that at 280 watts for 5 minutes to stay with the Peloton, because that's what it's taken in the past, and in the past I've gotten dropped because I couldn't hold 280. And so looking at my friend's power data, I discovered he held 280, we're about the same body weight. So whatever way we figured out, somehow we figured out that it takes 280 watts to get over the climb with this group, I can now start measuring that. Whereas before, if I didn't have a power meter, I would have absolutely no way of measuring this. It would strictly be just by feel, and by golly, I got it right or I didn't. But if you have a power meter, now we can measure it, and I can say, okay, now I can need to start climbing hills at 280 watts for 5 minutes and see if I can build up to that. And so we've measured performance, and we've gauged exactly how we're going to do on that particular hill in the race during the training session.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Joe Friel about his new book, The Power Meter Handbook, and how to use a power meter and why to use it and when to use it. And that's one of my questions. Should you both train and race with the power meter? I mean, leave it there all the time, or do you want it only for training?
Let's talk about different kinds of events. Let's say we're talking about a time trial or triathlon. In that kind of event, steady state, it's very, very beneficial to have a power meter on the bicycle because what the athlete wants to do is to hold a relatively steady power throughout the race, and so it allows the athlete to do that. It's almost like cheating in a steady state race like a time trial to use a power meter. It makes it really pretty easy to do. So, yeah, in a race, in that case, it helps a lot. In a road race, a little bit different story now. In a road race, the power output is being dictated largely by activities of the group and people who are attempting to drive the group relatively hard or break away from the group or whatever. And so the numbers are changing dramatically throughout the ride from very, very high to very, very low and without any, perhaps really any pattern associated with it. So now the athlete is not going to gauge the intensity based on what he sees on or she sees on the handlebars. Now it's going to be strictly based on what's going on around the athlete. So in that case, having a power meter on the bicycle is not really critical to the performance itself on the race. However, where it's important is afterwards when you analyze the race to see what it took to do this race at a high level. How many matches did you burn? How big were the matches? How long were the matches? That's critical information for a road race. Taking this information then, applying it to training, saying, well, this is what I need to be able to do this particular type of race, now allows you to design training programs based on performance that you want to see in a race. That's kind of what I was explaining earlier. So it's certainly important for both types of races. It's just a variance in when we use the data.
Wow, that makes perfect sense. That was awesome. So what is FTP and why is it important?
FTP. FTP stands for functional threshold power. It's a brilliant idea that came from Andy Coggan, PhD. Andy's had a lot to do with impacting how we use power meters in training. And basically, before he came along with this idea, and for example, when I was just trying to figure out how people should use heart rate monitors back in the 1980s, I finally decided the best way to set up heart rate zones was to base them on their lactate threshold heart rate, which sounds really good until you start trying to explain to somebody, to an athlete, what does lactate threshold mean? And you get into a lot of physiology and it has to do with all kinds of complicated things that really aren't all that important to the athlete. But nevertheless, it always brings up some information, some ideas from the athlete on what they should be doing in training and how to go about finding this particular heart rate to base their zones on. Well, when power came out, I started thinking the same way. I needed to have a lactate threshold power for the athlete. And so began to toy with that and how we would do it. And about that time, not too long after that, Coggan came out with this idea of functional threshold power, which is much simpler, much more to the point, easily understood by anybody, I don't care who it is. The basic concept is that you can, an athlete who's in decent shape can hold their lactate threshold for about an hour. This lactate threshold is a critical moment in the effort being applied by the athlete to the pedals, the bike, and how hard they're riding. It's the point at which you begin to redline. And so we know an athlete can hold that for about an hour. So all Coggan said was instead of trying to go to a laboratory and have lactate measured or do other ways of figuring out this lactate threshold, let's just use an hour. Let's just say whatever power you can average for 1 hour is your and what he called functional threshold power. In other words, it came from the function rather than from measurements of lactate. And so it's simply, FTP is just simply the average power an athlete can hold for 1 hour at a maximal effort.
Well, that's simple enough.
It is.
That makes perfect sense. So finally, I want to really talk about if you think that everyone would benefit from using a power meter as a training tool.
Oh, gosh. As soon as you say everyone, we can say no, that's probably not going to happen. Not everybody's going to benefit. There's some people who don't do it at all for performance. Power meters are performance measurement tools is what they are. And if a person's not concerned with performance, if they're just trying to lose body weight, for example, a power meter is not going to be a big deal to them. But as soon as we start saying performance, as soon as the athlete says, I want to do X in this event, now a power meter is going to be very beneficial because it allows the athlete to train in a way which is specific to that event. That's kind of things I was touching on before with, you know, the kind of way of describing how we'd use it to set up intervals or workouts or hill climbs or whatever. So it's going to be beneficial anytime the athlete wants to try to produce his given performance in a event of any type. Could be a century ride. Doesn't have to be a race.
Well, I think that along with your other book, The Training Bible, and your first triathlon, you know, doing your first triathlon, this is a really interesting book. The Power Meter Handbook, A User's Guide for Cyclists and Triathletes by Joe Friel. It's published by Velo Press, and I enjoyed reading it, even though I'm not a very technical person. So I think that anybody who's interested, as you say, in performance would benefit. Thank you so much for joining me again on the program. I'm sure I will get back to you for other things about performance and training, and I hope you have a very happy holiday.
Sure, Diane, anytime.
Thank you.
Bye.
Joe Friel is the author of a new book entitled Power Meter Handbook, A User's Guide for Cyclists and Triathletes.
Yes, I learned about power.
He joined us from Scottsdale, Arizona. Lucky him.
Yeah, I'll bet it's beautiful. You noticed I didn't even ask about the weather. It's always nice in Scottsdale, I think.
I would be afraid to use a power meter.
Why?
For the same reason that many people are afraid to step on a scale.
You're thinking you'd be inadequate? Is that your point?
The truth might be too ugly to comprehend. So.
Oh, I'm sure you're pretty powerful. You're pretty efficient.
You know, better not to know.
Some of it's about efficiency,
okay.
Too.
All right. I'm not sure. Well, maybe I should. Now you got me curious. Maybe I'll try it sometime.
All right.
Just for the curiosity
for
factor.
For grins and giggles or whatever they say?
Yeah. Not this year. Maybe next year.
Okay.
Talk to me in 2013.
I will.
Okay. All right, we got to scoot on out of here.
We do.
But thanks for listening. And, of course, we'll be back next week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.